The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we look at the ways that cultural norms, biases, and even language influence the practice of science. What effect does culture have on the results that scientists get from their work? And how does the social wiring of the brain influence the questions that they ask in the first place? We're joined by Mike McRae, author of the new book, Tribal Science, and Marie-Claire Shanahan, assistant professor of science education at the University of Alberta. Enjoy.
I'm here with Canberra-based science writer Mike McRae. Mike writes and illustrates for several educational publications produced by the Australian Research Organization, CSIRO. He has finally succumbed to numerous people's prodding and has written the new pop science book, Tribal Science, Brains, Beliefs, and Bad Ideas. Welcome back to the show, Mike.
Thanks, Sis.
So full disclosure. I myself have been harassing you for this book for about a year now. I love society and science conversations, and this book brings a few new angles on it. So before we start, is this book even available in Canada yet?
Not yet. It's available in Australia through University of Queensland Press. I'm looking at getting it made available in the US and the UK. There are some people who are looking at the moment going, let's see how it does over the next month or so in Australia. But that said, you can order it and get it sent overseas, and I'm sure I can always help in getting it shuffled across to people interested.
So you start by talking about some of the theories around why humans develop these wonderfully clever brains. Can you tell us about some of those theories?
The big question is, why is it that humans have the intelligence to be able to not only deal with their environment by mentally modeling it, but imagining that model, manipulating it and changing it in various ways? I mean, it's remarkable that we not only understand what's happening around us, but we can think about the whole process of thinking. We often treat our brains as if they're not biological at all, that they're connected with the universe in this direct sort of way. But we don't often stop and really think, why is it that this animal has evolved to this point where it can mentally model its surroundings? Why should an organism have that? Perhaps it's a form of sexual selection. You know, if we can actually show that we don't have brain parasites, then we'll do quite well in improving our intelligence. And there's obviously the thought that we can interact with our environment in certain ways and do better by predicting things that are going to happen if we have a big brain. The thing is, that model of actually mapping our environment in ways so we can predict it better doesn't really require the size of brain that we have. We're at a bit of a loss there. We sort of have to have another reason to explain why we developed this level of intelligence. But we're forgetting one particular environment by only focusing on the physical environment around us, and that's the social one. We have done so well as a species to learn how to interact with one another through language and through understanding what other people are thinking. So the dynamics that happen socially have helped to contribute to the growth of the brain. What that means is the tools that we actually have, those cognitive tools, are very, very social in their origin. So they're not really, they haven't really evolved to be able to look at the universe and understand it in terms of eons of age, or we don't look to the stars and really have an innate ability to be able to understand them in terms of radio waves or grand scales of distance. All of the tools we have inside our heads evolved pretty much in ways to understand what other people are thinking and how they interact with their environment as well. And once you start to look at the brain as a social tool that just so happens to have tools that are applicable to understanding our environment quite well, that's where you can start to understand why it is that we have not only good tools that allowed us to get to the point of understanding things scientifically, but why we also struggle in social terms with the concept of science and why it's so hard to get rid of certain pseudoscientific and paranormal beliefs.
You say this has something to do with our capacity for symbolism and pattern recognition.
The whole idea of actually looking at the environment and translating something you see symbolically into something you then communicate is a feature of our brains. It's how language pretty much works. So we've developed this ability that started off purely with, say, gesture. So the idea that you can recognize something in the environment and communicate that event to somebody else purely by pointing it out, building up to the fact that we can form words that represent an idea. So I can actually be talking to you right now, and I can describe the scene, and you'll imagine that scene. And then together we can manipulate it, even though neither one of us needs to be looking at that scene right now. So that whole idea of symbolism, the fact that you can actually take ideas and interpret them in a particular way, the fact that in cultural context there's this vague metaphoric inchoate concept that surrounds all of it. So you not only get that strict dictionary definition, but you also get a sense of what I'm talking about that can be flexible. So the symbolism our brains rely on to be able to communicate things emotionally, figuratively, and also literally, is quite complex. And yet, again, it's not done really to be able to manipulate our world in such ways. It's done so we can interact with one another as a species. So looking at the brain as this individual organ that operates on its own, I think it's a bit of a mistake. I think we've done that for quite some time. What we should be doing is looking at the brain as an interactive organ that almost has to be operating with other brains to be able to understand in its complexity.
Well, now we're at an interesting societal point. Science is seen as elitist and not to be trusted, but at the same time, anything that sounds vaguely sciencey is given credibility. So how can both those perceptions exist at the same time, and what does that have to do with our tribes?
If you think about the concept of science as being trustworthy, it really only goes back roughly a century and a half. You know, the very word science really isn't all that old in itself. You know, and our ideas as a culture in trusting in science kind of goes back to the times of the Industrial Revolution, when you had the British government primarily sort of thinking, how do we get our population engage with science so we can actually get innovation occurring and not have to rely on other countries to come up with ideas. And that idea of communicating to the public that science is productive has pretty much started this whole idea that has carried on over the decades, that science is a rigorous process that gives you results. So that's how we are today, I guess, with science in that way. However, the philosophical side of science, the fact that it has a skeptical angle, is something that a lot of people still struggle with, because it takes a conflict of culture really to be able to sit back and go, someone else is thinking something differently to me. I have to reflect on my own values, I guess, in certain ways, and see where I've gone wrong, and maybe even accept the fact they're right. And that doesn't work really all that well with our social brains. So even within scientific communities, you're going to have your cliques, and you're going to have your groups, your tribes as such, that resist certain ideas, but always in the end, I've got that notion of, if we can test it and observe it, maybe then we have to go back to our original idea and rethink it.
You say that our social brains are inclined to rely on the likability and trustworthiness of experts. So how does that affect us?
Well, it affects how people communicate science. There's no such thing as information in a vacuum. All information we have comes from a source, and we're always going to be looking to that source and asking questions about how we affiliate with it. Even if it's a newspaper and we just open up the front page, there's still going to be that sense of, well, what does this newspaper actually tell me about its trustworthiness? You know, who's writing it? Is it a little more left-wing? Is it a little more right-wing? There's a relationship between the information and its source, no matter how removed it might seem. That's going to always be wrapped up in a social sense. So you're always going to be evaluating that information by the values of the person who's presenting it. And there's going to be little clues into that. So there's going to be certain sentiments of what other things they might believe. You know, if they're a churchgoer and they go to the same church as me, then that's going to slip in and basically encourage, you know, your feelings. And there's ample research to actually show that no matter what your values are, you could be so fully into science, you read science every day and you think very scientifically, those people who present information you're still going to be evaluating their values in a non-scientific sense. So it might be something as simple as the way that they look, you know, the clothes that they wear. Do they appear to be dressed in a way that you might actually sympathize with? All those things are going to impact on how you might feel about the information they're presenting. So something as straightforward as simply how they write, there's full of spelling errors. There will be people who go, well, they're spelling errors, I don't care what they're saying. That gives me some clues about their education or about how they speak. Or if they speak with a certain accent or a slang. So we do that constantly with all different aspects of communication, evaluating it not so much on its rigor, but more on, do you belong to the same tribe I do? And can I trust you as part of that?
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking with Mike McRae, author of Tribal Science, about how human social nature may make it inherently difficult to think critically. Now, you say that magical thinking is kind of what we're predisposed to do.
Magical thinking actually works on a number of levels. So if you really think about how magical thinking operates and understand the universe, we're not setting out to draw rigorous connections between observations and find actual relationships that are impersonal. Magical thinking relates to more of a personal relationship that we hold with the universe. So it's very much a social thing. Now, you know, something as simple as seeing faces in the clouds or seeing a face in a rock, for instance. Faces are as personal as it gets. You know, they are ways that we recognize one another as being friend or foe. In fact, we have a Larry the Brain that's devoted purely to recognizing faces. You know, it's called the fusiform gyrus. So the very fact that we've got that ability, it's not just that we recognize a face. It's the fact that that face will have meaning. Which is why if you have a look at, for example, I think just the other day, there was a pizza that was actually baked in Brisbane, in Queensland, that came out with the face of Jesus on it. And you'll have some smart mouths that'll go, well, I think it looks more like Charles Manson, or I think it looks like, you know, we can put any sort of figure onto it. However, if you've got those values that says, well, I tie to that something a little more important, a little more significant, I think that's going to be some deified figure. It's going to be Jesus or Muhammad or whatever. It's more than just a face. It has meaning. And that's where the magical side comes into it, is that once you start thinking about it, the logic breaks down. But that doesn't dismiss the fact that you still have that sense when you look at a face that there's some potency to it, some power. We're all susceptible to thinking in that manner. We're all susceptible to actually approaching information in a certain way and attributing to it certain characteristics that may not immediately be rigorous or impersonal. It's kind of how the brain operates in a social sense, to automatically attribute something to it that doesn't have an immediate denotative form, but does have some sort of an emotional connection to it. And sometimes some of us are able to stop and reevaluate according to the social values we have and go, well, hang on a second, you know, that looks like a face, but obviously there isn't any great meaning to it. But not all of us have those values. And sometimes that symbolism or that magical thinking is so strong in certain social groups that it has such significance that it's not something you're going to think beyond. It's going to feel as if it is important. And that's something we really can't dismiss. I mean, if you think about it over the centuries, the very notion of trying to describe life as being distinct from all other systems in the universe, so all other chemistry, all other physics, that there's something unique about life. The term vitalism is what we use to describe that notion that there is more to life than just physics and chemistry. And that was quite a powerful influence on how we studied biology for centuries. In fact, really up until the early 20th century, there were still quite serious scientific notions that there might be some other force that describes life in general. And it wasn't necessarily out of observations. The real motivation behind that was more feeling that there has to be something more to life than chemistry. So it's quite a powerful force, and it really is something that stems out of our brain's tendency to look at things socially.
But isn't the general idea that we'll sort of grow out of believing nonsense and towards things that actually have evidence behind them? And I'm not just talking about individually, but as a society.
There is a sense that we're going to be more logical in the future, more reasonable and rational. I'm not sure where that comes from, to be honest, other than the fact that we do have those values in our community today that says you get more productive beliefs that come out of behaving in that fashion. So I think there will be more of a tendency for people to hold on to those values as we go into the future more. And we'll never get rid of pseudoscience and such, but what will actually make something of a difference is when we encourage greater communication between cultural groups, because really that's where science has come from. It wasn't just the development of an appreciation of rationality. It didn't just come out of logic. The real big motivator for creating this system of science that we have was about communication between groups who could sit there and look at their own beliefs and communicate about them and actually say, well, I'm prepared to let go of what I believe in and defer to our observations and discuss what we might believe and then see what observations come out of that that will substantiate that. And I think that's what will make the big difference, is that level of communication as we go into the future. And we're seeing little tiny bits of evolution, I guess, in that along the way. I mean, if we look last year with NASA coming out with their claim that a species of bacteria that they've been studying had taken arsenic, you know, which is poisonous as far as, you know, much of life is concerned, taking arsenic and replacing the phosphorus in their DNA with it. Now, that's pretty amazing if that can be substantiated. And we'll look to the future and see whether that does happen or not. But right now, it's a discussion. And the blogosphere went wild over it. You had people all over the internet discussing this potential discovery. And you had some people who then had a look at what NASA had put out there and went, look, from what they have written, I'm not convinced. I think there's some problems with their rigor. And yet NASA was less concerned with what blogs were saying and more concerned with what was being put in journals.
Right.
So it was the communication. They were trying to say communication belongs in the journals here, not thinking that actually science itself is what happens in that communication. So you have this whole world of people who are interested discussing and gaining or losing confidence in a particular belief, which really is what science is about. So constraining it within particular social groups and saying, well, it's what happens when these social groups communicate by these ways, is restricting science in ways that really just doesn't work that way. It never has worked that way. It's what happens when it's passed out and filters through the rest of the community. And when you've got ideas that evolve that way and then come to have a certain consensus in the community and then applied in certain ways. And so you can see this conflict at the moment where you get some parts of the community saying, no, science is what happens when these people talk and these are the ideas that they have. And outside of that, we'll draw a line and we'll say, well, it's no longer science. And it's interesting whenever we try to put restraints on what science is and is not, we soon see that it just bleeds over the edges of that. And I think that's the great thing that's happening in the future, is that level of communication is going to be more diverse. We'll be talking with people who we wouldn't normally be associating with. What we've got to work on now is supplying people with those tools to be able to not only think critically and not only think reasonably and logically, but to be able to communicate across the cultural boundaries, to actually be able to talk to people of different tribes and not talk at them, not lecture them, but interact and sort of make it into a two-way discourse where it's you thinking about how they're approaching a particular issue, how they're approaching their ideas, and how you think you might be able to communicate what you have using the right words, using the right metaphors to get your ideas across. And that's where science will start to accelerate, I think. Always in between, there's going to be that risk that ideas we produce are going to be bad ones. But that is always going to be the risk. It has been since day one. The wonderful thing we'll have in the future, I think, is that idea of science will be owned more by the community rather than just by specific individuals who want to actually put boundaries on it.
I'm talking about the human need for community and what it means for science and reason with Mike McRae. We'll be back with more Tribal Science after the break.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com. Or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm on the line with Mike McRae. Mike's the author of the new book, Tribal Science, Brains, Belief, and Bad Ideas. Well, I'm wondering now, theories that aren't backed up by evidence, why exactly aren't they relegated to the dustbin of history? Let's say. Is there a tribal reason?
The question, I think, is often glossed over on what evidence is. You know, we use that word as if it's got the same meaning to everybody. And you'll see so many arguments that sort of degenerate into this session of bickering over whether something constitutes evidence or not, without really starting to think that the evidence, you know, evidence is a very personal sort of thing. Yeah, if you really want to find a definition for evidence, you can't go past the fact that any definition you have, it's an observation that increases or decreases your confidence in how robust an idea is. So, you know, if you say, well, you know, I've got evidence of the Earth being at the center of the universe, for instance, and someone else goes, well, hang on a second, I'm going to use an observation of the sun actually moving around the planet of the Earth. Well, that's going to be evidence of the fact the Earth rotates. So, you know, using the same observation can actually be evidence in two subtly different ways. So the idea of using evidence is usually just using the term as a shortcut to say what is increasing or decreasing your confidence in an idea that you have that explains, you know, it's a relationship between different observations. So when we actually talk about evidence, in which case, and say, well, there's evidence for this, and then presume that it's a universal concept, that evidence is objective in and of itself, we've done ourselves this great big disservice. We're just sort of missing the fact that it comes down to how do you determine that an observation is or isn't evidence, and you know, what features of that process add a level of usefulness to determining it. So, I mean, that's really where critical thinking comes into it. Is that if somebody says, look, I saw a photograph the other day of an alien autopsy, to them that's evidence of the fact that aliens exist.
Right.
Someone else will be looking at that same photograph and then go, well, hang on a second, I don't think that's evidence because you haven't taken into account the fact that that could be easily faked, and I'm also weighing up the fact of this great history that we have where aliens just really haven't occurred, where you know no one else has seen an alien. So you're sort of weighing up two lots of evidence, that of the history that you understand and that of this photograph possibly being faked. Whereas if I come along and show you a picture of my cat and say, look at my cat here, you're going to go, well, this photograph is evidence of my cat. So now a photograph is evidence. Before it wasn't. But you're also using the history of the fact that, well, cats exist. You've seen plenty of them. You know people have them. And it's really unlikely that I have gotten some latex and some fur and made a model of a cat just so I can pass it off as, you know, this photograph. So again, you know, learning how to take an observation and evaluate it critically to come to the conclusion that it is evidence for or against something really depends on that process, depends on the values that we use. And they're quite complex. They come from our cultural background. They come from our social group. So it's something we learn as we grow up to look at an observation and use all these features to come to the conclusion that that observation is evidence for or against something. If you have a strongly religious background, you might be using certain sentiments. You may have this disposition to look at the universe as being personalized. So there is a God, there's a deity that controls things, and that's always going to be influencing how you determine evidence for certain things. So if somebody spontaneously gets better, that is going to be evidence of the fact that God touched them in some way and you know, magically made them better, because they're arriving at that with this concept that the universe is personalized. Whereas if you have more of a scientific background, you'll be taking into account all of the theories and beliefs of people who have looked at things critically. And again, you know, they share your cultural values and they've come to a conclusion that you find is going to be a useful way to understand the universe. Sometimes we come from a very privileged position where we look at things as being the right way. So we then say, well, we've got a scientific background. That is what evidence is. Evidence is scientific. But you do get into a little bit of a circular reasoning with that, where you say evidence is scientific. And you go, what's science? Well, science is that which evidence supports. And it's kind of hard to break out of that, where you have to start seeing it as a social construct. The difference being, obviously, that science seems to produce results that are predictable and useful in some way. So I can actually use science to say this is going to happen in the future, and you know, a lot of the time it does, and that's quite a useful thing. And we then use that to say, well, that's the truth of the way the universe operates. Now, obviously, I support that, being of scientific background. But the important thing is to be able to look at that, I guess, in a tribal sense, and then say, well, why is it somebody else is using the word evidence in a slightly different way? Why am I not communicating with them clearly when I say, no, that photograph of an alien is not evidence, or no, the fact that she got better from lung cancer is not evidence of God? Because they're obviously going to say, well, yeah, it is.
But is this kind of concept something that you can lecture to people about and suddenly they'll see sort of the error of their ways?
No. The right. Short answer is no. You can't kind of just say to someone, look, for the main reason that, again, that level of communication, when they're going to be taking your information and trusting in it, is going to, again, be evaluated according to their values. So if you have gone up to someone and saying, well, you know, God doesn't exist, automatically you are not part of their tribal group. You're not part of their social group that believes in God. So it's not a simple one-off event that you can say, this doesn't work in that way. It's actually quite complex, the changing of tribal groups. And don't forget, I'm talking about this very singularly as if we all belong to one group, but we don't. We move through multiple groups every day. You'll get up and go to work, and there'll be sort of a group there that you'll relate to, interact with. You'll speak a certain language that will have jargon in it that's very particular to the job that you do. You'll hold certain goals and values about the work that you're doing that'll produce an outcome. And that's one tribe. And then you'll go play sport. And again, there's a different language being involved. You'll behave in a slightly different way. You'll have different goals and values there. And you go home to your family, and once again, there'll be a bit of a change. So we move through all these different tribal groups. And understanding how we move through those groups, the language that we use and how we interact with other people and how we relate to the way that we use words when we communicate and relate to the values that other people are understanding your beliefs in is key to helping other people. And it's not going to be a single one-off process. It is going to be something that has multiple approaches. It's going to have interactions that have to occur over a long period of time. But not only that, it has to encourage in a person that ownership of the beliefs that they have. So in educational terms, it's referred to as constructivism. So the idea that you are behaving in such a way that you can construct your own beliefs from the information that's there, whether it's information somebody gives you or information you picked up simply by interacting with your environment. In terms of social epistemology, so you know the way that we form beliefs, when we actually form our epistemology in growing up, we go through various stages. And the stage that's most useful is when you get to a level of evaluative epistemology. The whole idea that you can think about beliefs in a flexible way that means you constantly modify them according to what you're understanding. That's kind of tricky to get to. Not a lot of, you know, not all people actually arrive at that. A lot of people still have very concrete views on beliefs as being very black and white or being diverse in certain ways, but being right from their cultural background. So getting someone to an evaluative point, you can't do that by lecturing. It does have to be a process where they are seeing that value and being able to think that way and feel relaxed about doing so, feeling encouraged to be able to actually change their beliefs without it being judgmental and without them losing connection with the tribal groups that they feel a strong part of. That's really hard to do. And the one way you won't get to it is by judging or by using language that is going to isolate people. What will actually work is appreciating it's a slow, gradual process and empowering people with the skills to be able to do that on their own and the desire to be able to move between their tribal groups and still feel connected with them whilst actually challenging their beliefs.
Mike, that's our time. Thanks very much for being here.
Not a problem. Thanks, Des.
Mike goes into much more detail on all of these topics in his new book, Tribal Science, Brains, Beliefs, and Bad Ideas. You can find out more at tribalscience.com. We've also linked to it at our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. Stay tuned for more science and culture with Marie-Claire Shanahan after this.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
I'm here with Marie-Claire Shanahan. Marie-Claire is an assistant professor of science education at the University of Alberta. She researches the interactions that people have with each other in science. In addition to research, she teaches courses in science teaching methods, sociology of science, scientific language, and educational research methods. She's also an active blogger, writing her own blog, Boundary Vision, and contributing to the Scientific American guest blog. Marie-Claire, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Now, as we said, you research the interactions between science and culture. But people
yes.
often think of culture as referring to ethnic background, but that's not exactly what we're talking about.
No, that's right. When I say I study science and culture, I mean that really broadly. The language that people use when they speak to each other, choices about being formal or informal, what is the expected way of interacting? What are the right ways of doing things? What are the ways that would make you seem like an outsider?
So then what's some of the research that you've done in this area?
Places where people interact is what's most interesting to me. So the types of things that I do, I'm just finishing up one study right now, looking at a program that brought science teachers into research labs for a summer program where they come in as research assistants to learn about science and they work as interns. But our program was a little different. One of the local funding agencies had a real requirement that these labs create outreach materials. And in this case, the science teachers were brought in as experts. They were there to help the research centers create educational resources that were going to be used in schools and be really good resources. So what I was looking at is this meeting between two types of experts that happened in this summer program, research experts and science teaching experts, and how they worked together and whether they were really able to respect each other as experts and find ways of communicating about their different cultures, and to, at the end, how well they came together to produce a product.
I'm thinking there's probably about a dozen ways that I can progress with this interview.
Sure.
So let's start with how culture affects scientific research specifically. Does it affect what subjects are researched in the first place?
I think that it does. And there's lots of ways that that's true. Researchers are people who typically go into something because they're passionate about it. To make their way through graduate programs and sort of through the career ladder in science, they've typically chosen it and chosen a particular area for a reason. That makes a culture where people are choosing, in many ways, first of all, the things that they're really interested in. So you get groups that will work together towards a particular goal that they're driving towards. There is, of course, also the cultural component of funding. And especially in North America, a lot of research funding is government funding or corporate funding. And again, especially government funding is going to have a cultural element to it. Things that are prioritized, things that meet policy needs, that are even going to serve a particular government or particular party's needs in terms of what they feel is the right type of scientific research to be done, funding gets directed at those things. And so in that way, culture and priorities really drive what scientists are able to do because it drives what they're able to get funding to do.
So then it's not a conspiracy theory to think that morality or political interests, let's say, play a part in the direction of research.
I don't think that's a conspiracy theory at all. It can have a negative connotation, but on the other side, it can also be a way of really driving at what a culture wants to find out, what the public prioritizes. So it also is a way of science being responsive to culture as well.
And we do see this play out in things like stem cell research or climate science.
For sure we do. And of course, I mean, those are two where it can be really contentious whether governments are going to support. And there's been a lot of fighting about trying to convince those that have the power to direct research funds about what is the right thing to do, what people within the scientific community would like to see, and as well as different types of people who are outside of the scientific community. And all of them have a stake in big issues like that.
We have a question from Tom M.
Given the heightened rhetoric in the U.S. today, if Darwin was introducing his theory for the first time now, how do you think it would be received?
In some ways, the way that Darwin put his theory forward probably would be different if he was putting it forward today, because some of the ways that things were worded and framed really came from the time period and came from the way that people were thinking about things. But sort of the underlying idea of evolution and development by natural selection. This is complete speculation, but I have to say that it would probably be just as contentious perhaps, but in a different way. I think it might look more like stem cell research, for example, which is something that's very new. There would be those who are able to really see the evidence that's being presented with it and really come to an acceptance of and an understanding of where a theory like that came from and probably would be very comfortable with it. But it would probably have the same sort of jarring cultural meanings that it did in Darwin's time as well, and that it still continues to have today. Given the other controversies that we see around science, like stem cell research and climate change, I think it might have come to the same result of still being something that jars with some cultural views of the world and for other people makes perfect sense and brings together all of these biological ideas in a way that's really satisfactory.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking to Marie-Claire Shanahan, Assistant Professor of Science Education at the University of Alberta, about science and culture. So I've repeatedly had arguments with my less science-inclined friends about whether science is neutral or truly objective. So now my position is that the scientific method with properly established controls is able to offer objective answers to questions. But then again, humans are the ones doing the science.
You're absolutely right. It is always people. It is people coming up with the questions, people coming up with the interpretation. And even from this, the most mundane sort of view of that, we don't always have an ability to access all of the information. We see such huge revolutions in understanding science with the advent of different technologies, the advent of lenses, the advent of microscopic technology. I mean, these things totally revolutionized what the questions people were even able to ask. So even from that simple perspective, we can't ever have a complete answer. And in a sense, then we're limited by our humanness. And so in a sense, it isn't a perfectly objective answer because it is always in some ways limited by who we are. People ask questions for a reason. We ask questions because we think it will be interesting, the answer. We ask questions when we think that the answer is going to be important or valuable. And so there's questions that we don't ask, or we ask them in a way that we can only ask them from what we know and value. We can't ask them any other way. And again, it can't be perfectly objective. It's never a perfect answer. It's always related to who's doing the asking and who's doing the answering.
When we're talking about research, mm-hmm. I had Dr. Cordelia Fine on a while back, and okay. She spoke about some of the studies that have been done on neurology and gender. And mm-hmm. how even if the studies themselves weren't flawed, and some of them were, the mm-hmm. interpretations often did seem quite obviously biased, and yeah. I mean as in sexist biased. So mm-hmm. have you seen any of that in your work? Maybe not sexism per se, but interpretations that seem heavily biased towards the culture of the people particularly who conducted the studies?
Brian Wynn's a sociologist in the UK, sociologist of science, and a lot of his work is looking at case studies of times when there's been public issues and scientists have gone out to a community and tried to either come up with policies, come up with regulations. And so one in particular that he's looked at is in the 70s, decisions to go ahead with nuclear fuel options. Mm-hmm. The government had proposed basically to do an environmental study of the area where this plutonium fuel was going to be synthesized and worked with. And their idea of what the environmental study should look at was just the site, the most controlled version of an environmental study that they could do within the bounds of what was going to be called the site and what they were able to look at. And they were only interested in looking at what was highly controllable. As they brought the public in, people started asking about how is this fuel coming in and out? How is it being disposed of? People from the community continued to propose and propose and propose these questions, but the scientists that were on the panel wouldn't look at it because they couldn't control the variables. So their culture as scientists allowed them to only see this as a problem of a controlled site of what we could look at, and anything beyond that didn't fit in the way that they even framed the problem of what environmental assessment of this site was going to be. And I think that is a sense of bias. It's not in the interpretation, but even in the way of framing the question in the first place.
See, that's interesting because there are some cultures that in that situation would have some serious trust issues around science. And in fact, mm-hmm. there are certain communities that kind of inherently have some trust issues.
Yeah.
And I actually fairly yep. recently read a piece called Why Black People Fear the Doctor. And it was about some really disturbing experimental drug testing on Nigerian children.
Oh.
So what do you think about the idea that science has an additional obligation to be rigorous when dealing with research that involves marginalized groups?
Yes, they're absolutely committed to being rigorous scientifically, but rigorous ethically has to be a really, really important element of anything that scientists do. I sit on one of the social science research panels at the University of Alberta, and this is often the type of question that we're asking is when someone comes to us with a research project, especially when it deals with marginalized communities, is this exploiting the community or is this knowledge that's going to contribute to the community? Mm-hmm. But I think there's something particular in marginalized communities where it can seem like scientists may be just treated as a lab, just as a population to be experimented with. And I think that's something we can see in historic research almost certainly. But there's a really big push in research communities around the world to bring balance back into that and to bring a very strong ethical culture, and especially an ethical culture that highly values research is going to be of benefit to the community.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking with Marie-Claire Shanahan. She's the Assistant Professor of Science Education at the University of Alberta. And we'll be right back with more on science and culture after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, it's an hour on zombies. We dig into the fascinating ways these movie monsters overlap with real-world science. We talk to entomologist David P. Hughes about his work studying parasites that use mind control to direct the behavior of their hosts. And mathematician Robert Smith shares the results of his paper that models the best way to control the spread of a zombie infestation. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking on your local radio station or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Hello and welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Marie-Claire Shanahan, and Marie-Claire studies social interactions in science and science communications and teaches courses in science teaching methods, the sociology of science, and science language at the University of Alberta. So now one of the ways we have of dealing with some of these issues that we've been discussing is to diversify scientific culture by attracting more types of people to it. So How is that usually done?
That typically falls to the job of science educators, because we know that students' interest in science at a very young age can really predict whether they're going to study science in university and, more than that, whether they're going to continue and graduate with science degrees and even continue on. Their interest in grade 6, grade 7, grade 8 can really set them on that path. So a lot of those efforts have gone into teaching programs that bring role models into schools, that introduce students of color, introduce female students, introduce language minority students to role models from their communities who are involved in science, and provide mentoring for them and provide opportunities to encourage them.
Well, you recently wrote an article for the Scientific American website that discussed how the technique that was most effective in helping build a physics identity in women was a direct classroom discussion about underrepresentation in that field.
We had expected to see things like role modeling, things like female teachers. But we asked students, these were all first-year students, we grabbed them in their English class so that we got everybody, and the only requirement was that they'd taken high school physics. And we asked them all kinds of things. How long did you spend doing labs? Was your teacher encouraging? How many males in your class? How many females? How much time did you spend doing homework? How much outside of school time? Just everything to capture their experience. And as we said, we did really expect to see female teachers, female classmates, single gender groups, and opportunities for peer teaching and collaborative group work. We really expected to see those to be the things that were going to determine which female students had stronger identities. And as you say, the surprising thing was that the one that came back was whether they had explicitly discussed underrepresentation. We weren't in those classes. We weren't following these students. So we can't say for sure why it is that that particular discussion had the impact that it did. There has been some research in the area of stereotype threat or identity threat that looks at how even feeling nervous about being a woman or being a student of color, basically being in any situation where you feel that you might be judged just because of who you are, that type of fear can actually hold students back. And in that research, they have found that when it's explicitly talked about as a problem, that those students tend to actually feel less nervous. When someone comes out and says, yeah, you know, we know that there's this stereotype that women aren't good at math, but we know it's wrong, that students who heard that actually did better on the test. I think possibly there's something similar going on here. If there is a stereotype going on in the school that women aren't good at physics, or that girls, you know, it's not something that girls should want to do, that if their teachers are saying, you know, there really aren't that many women in physics, and there should be, that even that tiny little thing could be breaking a little barrier in terms of their nervousness. Instead of being nervous of confirming a stereotype, it's setting them up to be the person who breaks it. And that might be just one tiny little thing that's able to contribute to them going farther and succeeding in physics.
Do you think that research can be applied to other areas that are underrepresented then? I'm thinking people of color or people from a lower socioeconomic status.
Yes, I think so. And if that connection to stereotype threat is there, that type of research really has gone farther. I mean, women in math is just one of the things they've looked at. They've actually looked a lot at students of color and students coming from high need schools, English language learner students as well. So we just happen to look at physics students, but I think that's an effect that probably applies to a lot more things as well.
Well, this is particularly interesting because something that we hear a lot is that we keep having this discussion about underrepresentation and nothing ever changes. But what you're saying is that the act of simply having that conversation actually does change things.
Yes, just the act of the discussion in this case was valuable. And that's what we were really excited about with this research as well, because we have been talking about women in science and other forms of underrepresentation for a long time. And in some areas of science, things have changed a lot with respect to women, but they haven't changed necessarily with ethnic and cultural representation. And then in physics, it hasn't changed for women very much at all. And that is a big question. You know, why have we been talking about this since the 80s and it hasn't changed very much? And the thing that we were really encouraged to find was A, this discussion itself is valuable, and B, there really were still things, simple things in classrooms that can be done to increase interest. And we're not at a point yet where we can say, well, I guess it's just because the women don't want to be there.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the more subconscious reactions. You discussed the use of language as it relates to science. So mm-hmm. Can you explain that?
I mean, language is, of course, a complicated issue in science. Everybody that's taken, you know, even a first high school course in science probably remembers being taught how to write a lab report. We typically write it in third person. We write it in the past. The Bunsen burner was turned on. And it's developed historically that we have this writing style that science is typically presented in. But beyond that passive voice that we often talk about, one of the things in science, scientific language, that becomes really important is the idea of efficiency, of trying to convey a lot of information in often very, very small places. So a lot of conventions have also crept up around how to say things efficiently, pack a lot into a couple of words. And so we get this position that one of the key elements of scientific style is the noun phrase. And a really classic example of this that comes from linguist Martin Halliday. And one of the ones he often talks about is when we're thinking about the relationship between temperature and how glass will crack. If we're talking about in a scientific paper, the words we're going to use is this noun phrase. We're going to talk about the glass crack growth rate. And that takes all of the things that you and I might talk about and puts them into four words. That's actually a really difficult thing for a beginning reader to read, and a beginning scientific reader, I mean. Glass crack, it's even hard to say, glass crack growth rate. By the time you get to the rate, you have to go all the way back. What's the rate again? Does that mean fast or slow? Usually what's built into that is the fact that the rate is actually changing. So we're talking about speeding up or slowing down, like we're talking on the level of acceleration, and you have to get through all of that language to understand what's going on.
To get to the point. Interesting.
To get to the point. And so that's one place where students can be really discouraged. And this actually can really have a cultural component to it. Because that type of language is going to be more familiar for some students. Students whose parents are involved in science are going to talk in ways that better replicate that. So they're going to hear and read those things often. And in many ways, they can be socialized that, you know, that might be an obscure phrase for them. But that general idea of cramming things into these really long noun phrases is going to be something they're fairly comfortable with. And other students are going to be in a completely other position where the social use of language in their home and in their community never uses that construction. And so we get them into, again, grade 5, grade 6, grade 7 science. We start looking at things really in depth. We start using textbooks extensively that replicate this language, but rarely do we ever teach students to read it. We don't tell them how to pick apart these noun phrases. We don't usually even tell them why they're written that way. It can be a barrier, a brick wall of, I have no idea how to figure out what this is saying. And so scientific language, while it has its uses, can also be very exclusionary and very difficult. And it can be, again, one of those things that keeps students out because they just can't figure it out.
Now, we have a stack at this moment of listener questions, so let's get to some
okay.
of these. This is from Kylie Sturgis.
Is it true that young women are discouraged from getting into science subjects? Because the stats from international scholastic performance tests like PISA, TIMSS, and PIRLS seem to indicate that it's boys internationally that are less likely to be enthused by science at school. How does that explain future careers in some sciences? The hard sciences, I hate that term, being dominated by mostly men.
You know, in biological sciences, the representation is much, much different. I think most recent stats are about 60% in the U.S., 60% of biological science degrees are awarded to women. And physics, we just don't see that. It's, you know, 14, maybe 20%. You're right. A lot of the ability and understanding, which is what TIMSS and PISA and PIRLS really look at, is knowledge and ability. They don't all translate into wanting to pursue it as a career. So there's actually a study, it's actually ongoing, but they published an early piece in the UK. Jonathan Osborne's a science educator there, and he's one of the people involved in this. And they wanted to look at young kids, so again, 10, 11-year-olds, and start to ask them about why they would or wouldn't consider a career in science. And one of the most interesting things that I think they found was that even at that young age, there's actually quite a separation between being interested in science and actually wanting to do it. And they were, like we were surprised, they were really surprised at how different, how much of a distinction there was for students there. So we might find that, you know, male and female students, especially at the middle school, early high school grades, might be equally interested, or there might even be an advantage where girls are more interested. But that actually doesn't mean that they think it's possible or credible or interesting to go on into a career. And we're starting to see more and more that deciding on it as a career is actually a very different decision. It isn't just about interest. Students who talk about how cool they think science is and yet feel that it's an impossible career for them. It's not even on the radar. It's so far out of their realm of experience that they wouldn't even know how to go about doing it. And so it seems like an impossibility. It's something that other people do.
I have a question from the chat from Loxloy.
Is the way that science works hard for the public to understand, is that why they're likely to be persuaded by a more passionate or emotional viewpoint, such as mothers who are opposed to vaccines?
Yeah, I think there are elements. And one of them where there's often a disconnect between the scientific community and the public community is in the area of uncertainty. I mean, scientists rely on uncertainty language because they're working with preliminary information, they're working with small samples, they're limited by equipment. So they typically rely on language that expresses uncertainty. The most likely explanation is, or we suggest that, or it is proposed that. And I think that's a really difficult thing for those outside of science to really get a grasp on. When you're talking outside about what you know, you ask mothers about their children and talking about the care they give them, they don't think of it in terms of, I might suggest that the best way to do something is this. They know, you know, what their experience is, and based on that have a very strong views about what's the best thing for their child, and understandably so. They have a lot to back it up, a lifetime with their child. And so I think that's often misunderstood, why it is that we have to speak in uncertainties like that. And I think it leads people to, instead of understanding that it's part of this long-term development of really sound ideas, that it really comes from not knowing. You know, instead of being an expression of the search for the best kind of evidence, it's understood anyway by others as a way of saying, oh, we don't really know. So I think there is a disconnect. And I think that understanding the way that evidence gathers and the way that evidence collected and interpreted can be a real challenge for those outside the community to understand. And I think vaccination is definitely one of those places where uncertainty has played into the public discourse and led to a lot of confusion for people.
And we have a question from Cuttlefish Poet.
Is the community of science able to compensate for our petty human differences as we compete and share information?
Yes and no. That's never a good answer, is it? I think the culture of science is in some ways driven by that as well. Wanting to absolutely find the coolest, best, and newest answer does drive people as well. But the other side of that, of course, is that there is no science without a community of people doing that. There is no science without building on each other's information and learning from each other and sharing with each other. There was a study done of the Apollo moon scientists, really trying to ask what was their culture. So these were the geologists and physicists who were working for NASA in the labs and were hoping to use the Apollo missions to gather data and to really understand the relationship between the Earth and the moon, to understand the geology and the chemistry of the moon. So sociologist Thomas Geeran interviewed a lot of them. He followed them. He sat in their labs with them. He talked to them before and after basically every one of the missions. And one of the most fascinating things that, to me anyway, that he found was that when the scientists talked about each other, a couple of them were called out for being too subjective. There's one fantastic quote where one of the geologists says, "Oh, that person, he believes so strongly in his one opinion. You could take the moon apart piece by piece and put it at his house, and he still wouldn't change his mind." And the quote actually goes on to say, I think he might be unbalanced. But the coolest part is the other side of it. When Geeran asked them, well, who are the best scientists? And everyone came back to these same three or four who were seen to be the most subjective, were also seen to be the best. They were the most creative. They had the best ideas. They thought more and harder and different and better. And we don't get new ideas unless somebody pushes and fights, even when there's not enough evidence yet, even when everything that it says about the moon says that's probably not true. The only way we're going to get a new idea about the moon is for someone to argue, in a sense, a crazy idea. And as the evidence develops, sometimes those crazy ideas do really turn out to be the best explanation. So I wouldn't want to see the fighting and the competitiveness. I don't think science could work without it. It's just, of course, that it has to be balanced. You have to trust that despite the fact that you say the scientist would never be convinced, even if you brought the moon home piece by piece, you know that he wouldn't be doing science if he didn't have a commitment to evidence, if he didn't have a commitment to really finding the best explanation possible.
And I think I'll give the last question to Philip S. in Austin, Texas.
In a society where success is so important, can science help understand that failure is part of every success?
There are a lot of people who actually argue for bringing more history of science into schools and into the public discourse, because there are so many fascinating stories. We think of these historical scientists, you know, the only thing we hear about is the amazing ideas they had, the ones that turned out to work. We never hear about their bad ideas and how much they struggled and how much they fought and things that turned out to be ridiculous. And we really don't get to hear that. And I think there's a lot of failure in there that lots of us could learn from. And I think that's a wonderful reason to make the history of science and even the processes of modern science, to make that more public so that students and people outside of the everyday research community can get a better understanding of science, but also can get a better understanding of how much failure and how much work goes into those successes and how much determination to get over the failures is a part of any scientific success. Yeah.
And we are absolutely out of time. Marie Claire, thanks so much for being here.
Very enjoyable to chat with you.
And you can find Marie Claire at mcshanahan.wordpress.com. We've also linked to it at our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the podcast, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise
raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Lisa Skovanek. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.